Welcome to All Sides with Ann Fisher. We're going to talk about mental illness today. A shortage of child and adolescent psychiatrists in Ohio has inspired a new service for primary care physicians. Later on, we're going to talk to mental health professionals who are working to recognize and treat mental illness in children and teenagers, including Ohio Department of Health Medical Director Dr. Marion Sherman and Nationwide Children's Hospital psychiatrist Dr. John Campo about that. Right now, we turn our sights to a slightly older group, the college generation, and how one professor is working to address how they are influenced by the often damaging stereotypes embedded in popular film. Professor Tamara Daly is the chair of the psychology department at the University of Mount Union in Alliance, Ohio, where she teaches a course on how mental illness is portrayed in the movies and popular cultures. Welcome to the show, Dr. Daly.
Good morning. Thank you for having me.
You are also a National Alliance on Mental Illness, a NAMI, Ohio Stigma Buster, a role model. You live with depression yourself. Did that influence your decision to teach this course?
I think it did, in part. I'm a social psychologist by training. I'm not a clinician or a counselor. Mm-hmm. And, you know, my major area of study is in attitudes. And I had found that in teaching about prejudice and stereotypes that I just didn't have a hook that I could really catch students' attention with. I was also, you know, for a while doing some research with the local mental health board and becoming more of an advocate based on my own issues and concerns. So those things sort of dovetailed together for me to decide to create that class. And, you know, throwing movies out there and saying to college students, yes, you get to watch full-length films as part of class, that tends to get them in the room. So with that hook, they come in and the door's open. And once you get the door open, people are pretty willing to engage and really think hard about these issues.
Well, I thought we would kick off. We have audio cuts we want to listen to from some famous, some not so famous movies. The first one, people say quit dating yourself, but I watched this when I was in college. One Flew Over the Cuckoo's Nest. In the 1975 film One Flew Over the Cuckoo's Nest, the main character, McMurphy, played by Jack Nicholson, fakes mental illness to avoid hard labor on a prison farm. At the mental institution, Nurse Ratched runs the ward with intimidation and humiliation disguised as therapy. In this scene, Ratched discovers a patient named Billy having sex for the first time with a woman smuggled into the institution.
You know, Billy, what worries me is how your mother is going to take this.
Well, you don't have to tell her, Miss Ratched.
I don't have to tell her. Your mother and I are old friends, you know that.
Dr. Daly, this isn't a movie that you show in your class. Is it because it's just outdated, or where does this fall in the matrix for you?
Oh, for the first 5 years of the class, I did show it as the very first film.
Okay.
And my students, they had never seen it.
Wow.
They may have, I know. Well, remember, most of them were born, in the 80s. So
yep.
Most of them had never seen it. But they love it. They really connect with the characters and with the story. And it's a good film to start off the course with. I have replaced it starting this year with Shutter Island because I can hit the worst of the worst with that film with actors that they are more connected to right now. But in Cuckoo's Nest, it's an iconic film with brilliant performances, and it tends to hit some of the most challenging stereotypes. You have very unusual-looking men on the ward who are either small and childlike or they're large and misshapen. Some are just bizarre and a bit scary. Some are just silly-looking. So you have these combinations of images where people expect the institution to hold people who are childlike and competent, or they're faking it, as the main character is. And there's also an assumption that if you walk in those doors, you're going to lose your mind. There's an assumption of untreatability and contagion that you see in a lot of institution films.
So is it simply outdated? Was it ever the case? What's useful about it?
What's useful about exploring that film?
Yes.
Well, we talk about a lot about casting and about assumptions. Starting, you know, just to start off, people assume that they know mental illness when they see it, mm-hmm. that they can tell when a person walks down the street that person is sick. And what they're expecting to see is some set of attributes, some bizarreness quotient that they can recognize very, very easily. And the fact of the matter is that you can't. There's also an assumption that people really aren't sick, that they just need to try harder. And in Cuckoo's Nest, it may be subtle, but the men are, for the most part, argued by McMurphy to not need to be there.
Mm-hmm.
And if they would just man up, they'd be fine, because mm-hmm. they're largely emasculated. So in male institution films, what we look at is how women and the women in men's lives are described as having taken their manhood away, and so they're locked up. And if they just discover their manhood again, they'll be fine. And we explore a lot of those issues. But a good portion of the stigma messaging in Cuckoo's Nest is, A, that hospitals are all evil and the people who run them are evil, and, B, that people aren't really ill. They just need to get out from under the thumb of women, and they'll be fine. So it's a challenging film to work with, because it's captivating to think of people who are institutionalized as being there unjustly. And that image of mental hospitals is still very current.
Mm-hmm.
Many people believe that that's the way hospitals are, and that psychiatrists are torturers and things like that.
You have replaced that largely with the newer film from 2010, Shutter Island. In the 2010 film Shutter Island, Leonardo DiCaprio stars as a U.S. Marshal assigned to investigate the disappearance of a patient from a locked room at the Ashcliff Hospital for the Criminally Insane on Shutter Island. The patient was institutionalized for drowning her three children.
Give you a briefing about the institution?
All I know is it's a mental hospital.
For the criminally insane.
We take only the most dangerous, damaged patients, ones no other hospital can manage.
Now, what's different about this from the Cuckoo's Nest?
There are some of the same problems, although Shutter Island comes from a genre of you know, thriller kind of slash horror films. It's based on a Dennis Lehane novel, and that's, you know, kind of a pulpy area. Basically, you have every major negative stereotype you could possibly find about mental illness and about people who treat those with mental illness, all packaged into this film. When the film opens, you have the two main characters who are coming across the water into this dark and forbidding place. It's presented as an old Civil War kind of prison on an island that's very impassable. It's very hard to get to. The weather is awful. There's cyclone fencing. It's just a horrifyingly scary place. And once you get inside, some of the first of the patients appear, and they look very bizarre. It's common in these films to have the casting done in such a way that you have very odd, strange-looking people collected to represent patients. The one woman who was heavily featured in the media campaign advertising the film, she appears to be somewhat older, half her hair is missing, her teeth are filthy, and she's kind of hunched over and looks gaunt and starved. And that's, again, it's very common. And then you have just a multitude of characters who are presented as dangerous and unpredictable. I think probably the most dangerous message, though, is that as the twist unfolds, because basically Leonardo DiCaprio's character is actually a patient at the hospital who is a traumatized war veteran of World War II with a drinking problem who has murdered his own wife because she, in a psychotic episode, has drowned their children. So you have a package of these horrific kind of assumptions that psychosis comes from trauma. Trauma comes from a variety of experiences, and once you're traumatized and psychotic, you will always be violent. And that set of assumptions is something that, in our culture, we tend to assume violence comes with psychosis in a way that's unavoidable.
614-292-8513, or you can email us at allsides@wosu.org. You can go to our All Sides with Ann Fisher Facebook page as well. My guest is Dr. Tamara Daly. She's a professor at the University of Mount Union in Alliance, Ohio. She's a psychology professor. She teaches a class that uses film to explain stereotypes and good depictions of people who are mentally ill. If you have a question or comment, make that call, 614-292-8513. What has the reaction been to your, because when I was just going on blogs and reading up about Shutter Island, which I haven't seen and hadn't really planned to see it, because I'm easily frightened, but some people really, really love that movie, and they're offended that anybody calls it a slasher movie or a horror movie.
Mm-hmm. Oh, I love the movie, too. I very much enjoyed it. That doesn't mean that I can't interrogate the messaging.
Okay.
What my students are instructed to do, and most of them had seen it. When I asked before I showed the film in class how many had seen it, the vast majority raised their hands. And what I ask them to do is to watch the film in a new way, with the question in their mind, what messages would a film like this send to people in the audience about individuals with mental illness and the people who treat them? So what they're doing is actively watching and answering questions while they're viewing. Now, when my husband and I went to see the film, and he's fond of wishing that I would not work while we go out on a date, but I find myself doing that very same thing of catching these instances where the messaging is pretty negative. Now, there are positive examples too. An FX show, which is a cable network called Terriers, mm-hmm. did a series of episodes where mental illness is not the focus of the show. It certainly isn't, although the main character is a recovering alcoholic. He's shown having a sister with schizophrenia, and his approach to caring for her and being her sister and being her protector is extraordinarily positive. And it also shows the sister acknowledging and understanding her illness and returning to treatment voluntarily. And those are messages you just never see on television.
It's nice, too, when it's not the main focus, when mm-hmm. you can relax with it a little bit.
It was incidental to mm-hmm. the plot. It was just another aspect of his life. And he was shown dealing with it effectively, despite all the chaos in the rest of his life, and despite all the, you know, kind of ethical and moral challenges mm-hmm. his character presents. In the show as a whole, he's shown as being a very caring and devoted brother to his adult sister with a disability.
We have to take a break. My guest is Professor Tamara Daly. She is a psychology professor at the University of Mount Union in Alliance, Ohio, and we're talking about how she uses film to teach about stereotypes regarding mental illness. Give us a call, 614-292-8513, if you'd like to join the conversation, or you can email us at allsides@wosu.org. We'll be right back. This is All Sides on WOSU 820 NPR News.
For as little as $60 per year, you can support WOSU and get some great benefits, too. With a basic membership, you'll receive the WOSU Member Card, good for discounts at more than 200 area restaurants and attractions. You'll also receive a complimentary one-year subscription to Newsweek magazine, and you will automatically receive our electronic airfare program guide and our e-newsletter. To support the programs you love, sign up for a basic membership for just $60 a year. Visit WOSU.org and click Donate Now. And it is 14 degrees in downtown Columbus, a few snow flurries today and some sunshine. The high is going to reach 19, but with the wind chill, it feels like negative 5. Cloudy skies tonight, a low right around 10 degrees. Some sunshine for Wednesday and a high of 22. Wednesday night, cloudy skies and a low of 16. All Sides with Ann Fisher continues on WOSU 820 NPR News.
Welcome back to All Sides with Ann Fisher. My guest is Professor Tamara Daly of the University of Mount Union, where she teaches a class that uses film to discuss stereotypes about people with mental illness. Let's hear from another movie. Well, let's first hear from a movie that's in your that you use in the class, Dr. Daly. It's Canvas. It's from 2006. In that film, it depicts schizophrenia as an illness impacting the entire family. In this scene, the mother, played by Marcia Gay Harden, runs out of the house into the pouring rain.
Please, get out of the rain. Mary, no. Honey, please, get out of the rain.
It's okay.
I want to leave. I want to go away to the other Florida.
There's only one Florida, Mary.
Honey, come on. Get in the house.
There's no other Florida. Come on. Get in the house, honey. Get in the house. Why didn't you take your medication?
I don't need a medicine. I don't need a medicine.
Mom?
Chris,
in the house.
That's a very emotional scene.
Yes, it is.
In the movie, probably one of the more extreme. I didn't see the entire movie. I liked it a lot, though. What do you like about it?
What I'm fond of with Canvas, and it's disappointing that it didn't make a major run in the theaters, organizations like NAMI have picked it up, though, and use it in a variety of ways. But what I like about the film is that it's, number one, it's told from the point of view, mostly from the son, from the child's point of view, and how challenging it can be for kids to get their heads around the fact that they have a parent who has a severe mental illness. We have tended to be so silent and to not speak honestly about these kinds of illnesses, that kids are really challenged by that. He's presented kind of as an 11-year-old, 12-year-old boy, and as if you know you're embarrassed by your parents anyway at that age.
Yeah.
But then to have a parent who is psychotic, who is behaving bizarrely, and who does so sometimes in public is even harder. The scene you just played, though. The students watch the film, but then I play that scene for them again because I want them to really think hard about the kind of violence and agitation that does occur with psychotic disorders on occasion. And that scene depicts the kinds of experiences that families have from time to time and the kinds of dangers that they present. Very unlike the danger and the violence and the stuff that's presented in Shutter Island, this scene in Canvas is far more realistic for describing the real kinds of events that families with a person with a psychotic disorder are going to encounter in their own lives. You know, the appearance of neighbors out on the street, some neighbors being helpful and supportive, other neighbors being not so much, is also realistic. The fact that the husband just really doesn't know what to do. I mean, he's trying to rationally argue with his wife, and that's not working. And I think that underscores the importance of organizations like NAMI that help families to understand the illnesses that they're having to deal with inside their houses. Give them more tools to work with.
You know, the boy in that film even though he really doesn't understand what's going on, it's pretty amazing how children can accept.
Yes.
And mm-hmm. you felt like that was real. It felt right to me, but...
Very much so. And it's not to be missed that the director and writer of the film grew up, his mother has schizophrenia.
Okay.
So he was using some of his own experiences and his own challenges to build characters, to send that message that having a person in your life is not something that you have to just be ashamed of and hide. It's something that you bounce back, you are resilient, and you work with what you have and find ways of continuing to be supportive and loving in that environment.
And I think it's Panigliano,
mm-hmm.
The father in the film, he's one of the gangsters from The Sopranos,
yes.
I guess. And
yes.
he was eager to do the film because it was out of, you know,
off type for him,
and but he was also one of the producers of it. He grew up with a mother who's mentally ill.
Yeah, and he's become a very active mental health advocate since doing the film. He has stated publicly that while making the film, he started thinking a lot more carefully about his mother and her experiences and his experiences with her, and he started to think a lot more about his own experiences of depression, and he got treatment and faced stigma pretty quickly himself. When he was signing on for another film, his attorney calls him up and says, well, they're not going to insure you because it says here on your disclosure form that you're taking an antidepressant.
Which is a good thing, right?
Well, he's also taking Lipitor for cholesterol,
right.
And they'll insure him for that, but
yeah.
they won't insure him for depression because they're afraid he's going to have some kind of breakdown and not finish the film. So he faced that kind of stigma himself and has become quite an advocate. He has a website called No Kidding, Me Too, and has been doing some work in that area.
Let's hear a cut from another film. I know I don't think you use this in your class, but it's well known, and it's about another family. It's called Ordinary People. It was made in 1980, and in it, the main character, Conrad, returns home from a mental hospital following a suicide attempt. His father pressures him to go to a psychiatrist, and in this scene, Conrad has his first private session with Dr. Berger.
What do you want to change? I told you I'd like to be more in control. Why? I told you so people can quit worrying about me. Well, I'll tell you something. I'll be straight with you, okay? I'm not big on control.
He's sort of like, doesn't everybody want a therapist like that?
In the literature in this area, Dr. Berger is often called Dr. Perfect because he's empathetic in all of those special ways, and he seems to have caring oozing out of every pore, which is the exact opposite of a lot of Hollywood psychiatrists who are depicted as being pretty manipulative, if not outright evil.
Mm-hmm.
Never forget that Hannibal Lecter is a psychiatrist.
Right.
That's a bit more common out there than Dr. Berger. No, I don't use Ordinary People in the class. It's my students right now, they kind of see it as dated and a little too... It's a brilliant film. I enjoy it.
Mm-hmm.
But the Academy Award. Yeah,
mm-hmm.
they see it as being a little too made for TV and slow for them.
Isn't that interesting?
Yeah.
Yeah.
When they do watch it, I've had students write papers on it. They tend to get a little too obsessed with Mary Tyler Moore and hating her and blaming her for making the boys sick. And that's, if you're going to look at negative messaging, that's the only real negative in the film, is that too much blame lands on the mother as being at fault for this son's problem.
I was listening to an interview with the famous actor who directed it.
Mm-hmm.
I can't remember his name right now. But
Redford.
Robert Redford. And he said that wasn't his intention,
mm-mm.
That he understood that she was as much a victim of the situation.
Yeah, her stoicism is symptomatic of her own trauma.
Right. Exactly.
But audiences, they just think she's vile. they think she's horrible.
Well, she was an amazing casting, an example of amazing casting in a way. I thought it was very well done. 614-292-8513. Perry, you're on the air. Welcome to the show.
Hi, thank you. I was wondering if there really is a definition called criminally insane. And would you comment on this this psychopath who has an extra chromosome and has no conscience? I see them as populating the boards of these money center banks.
Well, the first part of the question, is there a category called criminally insane? There certainly isn't in psychology. We don't have concepts of that kind. Certainly in the public lexicon, we use that language all the time. The concept of insanity is a legal concept and is defined differently in every state, although there are some commonalities. Typically what you're looking for is whether or not the person can appreciate the wrongness of acts, whether or not at the time of an act the person had the capacity to control his or her own behavior and understand its wrongness. Some mental illnesses tend to meet that standard. Many others do not. Psychopathy, being a psychopath, which also is not a word that we use in diagnostic language, being a psychopath doesn't qualify. It doesn't meet the standard, the legal standard for insanity, because even people who are callous and manipulative and without conscience know what they're doing by the standards of their community is wrong. They simply choose not to control that. Now, the point about the extra chromosome, I'm not very familiar with that, other than that there is some controversy about individuals with some sort of genetic propensity toward callousness and antisocial qualities. It's a highly controversial research. There are some who dismiss it out of hand as being junk science and others who think it's very fascinating and helpful. I think the bottom line for me is that the vast majority of people, even if they had that genetic manipulation, are not violent, nor are they conscienceless. It's just that some are, just like everybody else. There are people with no genetic problems whatsoever, and they can be as vile and unpleasant as you can imagine. So I tend not at this point to find that research to be all that compelling.
Thank you, Perry, for your call. Heidi, you're on the air. Welcome to the show. Hi, Heidi.
Oh, hello. There was a static in the middle. I missed you there. Sorry. I'm really fascinated with your topic today, and I think this class sounds really
I know, I want to take
I'd
it.
Love to go. Yeah, I would love to, yeah. The thing I just thought we could bring up is how earlier you were speaking, about the characters on shows or whatever, they show a little bit into their lives, you know, like you were talking about on Terriers.
Mm-hmm.
And on Law & Order with Detective Gorin.
Yes.
They show, you know, that he, you know, a little bit about his mother and then a little bit more, and you learn more that she has some kind of psychosis.
Mm-hmm.
I think she's schizophrenic, I'm not sure.
Yeah,
but
that
what
was
he's
how
had
they
to deal with in his life, and that shows his quirks from it, maybe. And I just wonder what your comments were and maybe how it helps him at his job or hurts him in his life, you know.
Well, Law & Order Criminal Intent, when the character of Detective Gorin was on it, was very interesting from a stigma perspective, because what you had in Gorin was a man who's intensely, ferociously bright and sort of in a Sherlock Holmes kind of way, but he's also very psychology savvy. His mother is presented as having schizophrenia and as being relatively treatment resistant, that she's remained symptomatic and has been hospitalized more than once. But he is her advocate. He's very caring with her. He takes care of her when she's dying of cancer, and simultaneously has to deal with his drug-addicted brother. So that's all positive because it's incidental to his life and he uses it to inform his work as a policeman. On the other hand, every episode they throw out a diagnostic label as an explanation for a murder, and that's very difficult for stigma advocates, because every time you have a character presented as having borderline personality disorder or bipolar or schizophrenia who commits a homicide, it reinforces the negative stereotype that people with mental illness are inherently violent.
Well, that's interesting. I never looked at it that way. That was a good take. Thank you.
Thanks, Heidi. Let's listen to one more cut. This is from Girl Interrupted. In the 1999 film, Winona Ryder plays Susanna, a teenage girl who voluntarily chucks herself into a mental hospital after taking an overdose of aspirin. Soon after she arrives, she witnesses the forcible return of a patient named Lisa, who is given a shot to bring her under control.
Those nails again.
My God, what the hell was that?
That was Lisa.
What? And Jamie was your roommate?
Jamie was Lisa's best friend. She was sad last week because Lisa ran away, so she hung herself with a volleyball net.
Ugh. Is that one of the films that you use in your class?
Yes, I do. Because it's important to contrast the way women are presented in institution films with the way men are presented. Women in institution films, because we have a different set of stereotypes for women with mental illnesses, and you know the kinds of things that go wrong with men tend to be feminizing, whereas the kinds of things that are assumed to go wrong with women are often tied to violating feminine gender roles. And in Girl Interrupted, you kind of see that pretty clearly once you're looking for it. Angelina Jolie, this was a breakout role for her, but she is, you know, Angelina being Angelina. She is masculinized, she's tough, she has a filthy mouth, she's violent and aggressive and manipulative. She appears to have been engaged in prostitution and a lot of drug use and a whole variety of things that are just not things that nice girls do.
Mm-hmm.
When Susanna arrives, Susanna's a fairly clean-cut girl, but she doesn't want to go to college. She doesn't want to do any of the things her parents want her to do. She's cut her hair short. She's just not invested in being an upper society kind of young woman. She wants to be a writer. She wants to be something other than what's expected. Her attempt at suicide is not to be blown off as being unreal. It's definitely a dangerous thing for a person to do. She ends up in the hospital, though, and the impression you get is that treatment for girls, for young women, involves talking. It involves talking with each other and being emotionally connected. And even in her work with the therapist, she is, and the therapists are presented relatively nicely.
Mm-hmm.
She has to talk. She has to get her feelings out of herself. She has to be honest with herself and become cooperative. And then they will let her out. So she becomes a good patient, and then she can leave. In films with men, men get better when they go do guy stuff, when they go fishing, when they drink too much, when they have sex with women. Basically, Susanna has to stop having sex with so many men, stop doing drugs, talk with her therapist, write in her journal, and be nice to the other girls, and she can get out. So while the film has some positive elements, the therapists are actually, for the most part, either benign or they are actually helpful.
Yeah.
The staff is kind, for the most part, and the girls don't look as bizarre as what you see in other films. Still, you have this message that the girls really aren't sick, that they just need to get over themselves and move on, or they'll get stuck there. And if they get stuck there, they really will go crazy. And that message is sent in virtually every institution film.
Well, we have run out of time for this conversation. Dr. Tamara Daly of the University of Mount Union, thanks for joining us.
You're welcome. Thanks for having me.
Dr. Daly teaches a class using film to dispel stereotypes and myths about mental illness. When we return, we'll be talking about an effort underway in Ohio to help primary care physicians get the kind of psychiatric and psychological help for their patients that they need, even though there is a shortage in the state right now of psychiatrists and child therapists. We'll be right back. This is All Sides with Ann Fisher on WOSU 820 NPR News. Now, the next fresh air, how some financial institutions, including ones that were beneficiaries of federal bailout dollars, are profiting from the financial distress of homeowners. We talk with investigative reporter Fred Schulte of the Huffington Post Investigative Fund. Join us for the next fresh air.
And fresh air begins in 20 minutes, starting at noon. This is WOSU 820 NPR News, and tonight at 10 on WOSU TV, Frontline chronicles how the middle class is faring in this recession through the stories of the people at one hair salon. The film reveals the struggles of a small business owner and the various clients whose lives intersect at a New York City salon. From well-to-do bankers to struggling actors, each with a story to tell about how they're getting by in these turbulent times. Watch Frontline close to home tonight at 10 on WOSU TV. And it's 14 degrees in downtown Columbus, a few snow flurries and some sunshine today, a high of 19 degrees. Cloudy skies tonight and a low right around 10 degrees. With the wind chill, it'll feel like zero. Sunny skies for Wednesday and a high of 22. Wednesday night, mostly cloudy and a low of 16 degrees. All Sides with Ann Fisher continues. This is WOSU 820 NPR News.
Welcome back to All Sides. A shortage of child and adolescent psychiatrists in Ohio has inspired a new service for primary care physicians. Later, we're talking now with the Dr. Marion Sherman. She is medical director for the Ohio Department of Health. Welcome to the show, Dr. Sherman.
Thank you. Mental health.
I'm sorry. You're right, as soon as I was saying that. Mental health with the Ohio Department of Mental Health. And also Dr. John Campo, he is a psychiatrist with the Nationwide Children's Hospital. Welcome to the show, Dr. Campo.
Thank you. Happy to be here.
There's a shortage of pediatric psychiatrists, right, Dr. Sherman? Why is that?
It's a subspecialty of psychiatry, and it takes several decades to end up with that cap and gown of being a child psychiatrist. So it's just a shortage of psychiatrists and an extra shortage of child psychiatrists.
Why are – it is a subsection, so it takes more time mm-hmm. then to get into pediatric mm-hmm. psychiatry.
Yes, it does.
How short are we?
We're quite short. We're probably about half of what we should be in Ohio. And Ohio is below half in terms of all the states in the country with shortages. There tends to be more child psychiatry access on the coast.
So how do you has this been a long-term thing, and are you mm-hmm. trying to attract more people to the field? Dr. Campo, maybe you can jump in there.
Absolutely. I mean, I think that the length of training is an issue. The other issue is, frankly, in medical school and in training, being a psychiatrist, stigma still exists within medicine, not just out in society. Mm-hmm. I think things are improving, but I can tell you, I was trained originally as a pediatrician, and when I was telling folks at the end of my pediatric residency about what I was going to do, some folks were pretty enthusiastic, and others thought, well, gee, I hope you enjoy that because you're otherwise throwing your career away. So there is not a lot of encouragement out there, even though the fact is that what we do has great importance from a public health perspective. There are more adolescents that die from suicide than die from cancer and HIV and asthma and meningitis and pneumonia and influenza and diabetes and cardiovascular disease combined. And yet we tend to think about this as that psychiatry is somehow a treatment for the walking well, and it is far from that. The other thing that I heard in your intro that I really liked was that you mentioned that it's not just a shortage of child and adolescent psychiatrists, but also a shortage of other highly trained mental health professionals like pediatric psychologists and therapists, mm-hmm. Because that's the flip side of it. I think what we're talking about is how we can improve access for primary care docs so they can provide some medical interventions. But the flip side is that it's probably even harder to get psychotherapeutic treatment that's competent, particularly when you move out into rural settings. So I think there are a lot of reasons why there are shortages, and, you know, it's multi-determined.
614-292-8513. If you want to give us a call, you can to talk about this issue. My guests are Dr. Marianne Sherman of the Ohio Department of Mental Health and also Dr. John Campo of Nationwide Children's Hospital. You can email us at allsides@wosu.org as well. What exactly happened? Dr. Sherman, how does this work now, the Pediatric Psychiatry Network? How does that operate?
Well, we've talked for a moment about the shortage of the personnel, and so we've taken this initiative, which has taken a couple years to get the leaders across Ohio to come up with this design. Dr. Campo is one of those mm-hmm. leaders here in Central Ohio, as well as all of the children's hospitals and all of the child and adolescent psychiatry training centers in Ohio. So the design at this point, which launched on October 7, is that there's one number that any primary care provider, any pediatrician, family practice, anyone treating a youth can call that number and then can request a local provider. So we've got the children's hospitals and child and adolescent psychiatry folks who are the local providers depending on which region in Ohio they're in. And they can request, for example, Nationwide Children's mm-hmm. if they're calling and they think Dr. Campo's program has a lot of excellence in it, and then they can get an answer within 30 minutes to their questions. They can be on the phone with a child psychiatrist. So instead of the scenario which did exist, which is maybe handing that family member a referral, mm-hmm. and then they may have to wait 6 months to get in to see a child psychiatrist, okay. they can get on the phone, and then that pediatrician who actually has had psychiatry training, it's just more limited than the child psychiatrist, can get on the phone and can say, hey, I was thinking about this. What do you think about this diagnosis? Does this medication make sense? Does this type of therapy make sense? And they can get a consultation on the spot and have live treatment so that family can walk out with their child getting their needs taken care of in real time. So this network is taking the resources we have and then connecting in a collaborative network across the whole state of Ohio, so any physician in Ohio treating a youth can call in, and is providing that child psychiatry expertise within a half an hour of the call.
Dr. Campo, what are you actually taking calls, or are you fielding them, or how does it work from that end?
Yeah, we definitely take calls. We've been doing something like this for a time before, but I really do want to take a moment and just thank Dr. Sherman. She's done a fantastic job driving this effort along with her colleagues like Director Stevenson down at the Ohio Department of Mental Health. We have been taking these calls. We are doing it now. We have a child and adolescent psychiatrist on call, 24 hours a day, 7 days a week. During the day, it's especially easy and quick to access us. It's a little different later in the day, but we have folks available on pager, and we really are committed to answer the calls promptly and make sure that the primary care docs on the other end are feeling supported.
Dr. Sherman, I know it's probably statistically way too early to ask this question, but I will anyway because you just want to know, what are you hearing? Are there any trends that you're seeing? Is it pretty much what you expected? What do you know about the pediatricians, the physicians who are calling in?
The first couple of months?
Yeah.
As predicted, it's starting slowly because this is going to take building relationships and trust in the network. Thus far, it's very, very high percent of success. But of course, part of that is people like Dr. Campo out there answering the line.
Mm-hmm.
So they're getting the best of the best.
When you said that pediatricians, that they're already trained, what are they trained in?
As they go through their pediatrics training?
Right.
Dr. Campo is a pediatrician.
Okay.
Do you want to answer that?
Yeah, John? Dr. Campo, what's a typical pediatrician? What do they know about these issues?
Well, you know, I think it's – I really want to believe it's in improving. I'm an old guy, so I think probably you got less exposure back then to mental health. But I do think our pediatricians now come out with considerable experience in terms of developmental disabilities, in terms of the assessment of children with attentional problems and that sort of thing, less so with regard to emotional disorders like depression or anxiety or bipolar disorder. So the amount – I mean, learning how to be a pediatrician, these folks have a lot to learn, and I think that the mental health side of the curriculum has been, you know, has not been as strongly emphasized as it needs to be. Now, the American Academy of Pediatrics is now doing more of that and has just come out with some position papers on what pediatricians ought to know about mental health, and I think that's going to make a huge difference. Family physicians, I think, have always paid attention to this a bit more because they've treated folks across the lifespan. So they're over time, I think, they've been a bit more comfortable with these issues. But again, it's not that they don't have the ability to manage these sorts of things. Part of it is comfort, and part of it is having access to a system of care that kind of can help them take care of patients with emotional and behavioral problems in the practice. It's not as simple as just reading a pamphlet and going from there. We've got to find ways to help them change the care within the practice, which is one of the things that we're trying to do with the Pediatric Psychiatry Network.
Dr. Sherman?
Those are great points, and there's one issue, which is how much training the pediatrician gets during the residency. But a pediatrician in practice for 10 or 20 years gets a lot of real-time experience and continuing education. And I want to point out an example. 2 days ago, I was speaking with a pediatrician, a very well-known pediatrician in Ohio, who said to me, "It was unbelievable. Today, I saw a teenager in my practice who was not depressed." So he said now it's cutting. Every teenager is cutting on themselves. So these family practitioners, these pediatricians, they see a lot. They really are the front line. They see a lot of kids who are struggling in families. And the ability to get a kid into treatment quickly, accurately, properly, not necessarily on medication or higher medication, just right-sizing that treatment to the right type of treatment is very critical. And that's what this network will provide. That pediatrician now has someone who's got their back. So
right.
Maybe they took a chance before and they did the best they could with the child, but the diagnosis was unusual. As they say jokingly, the child didn't read the textbook as to how they were supposed to respond to that treatment. And that pediatrician could not get support from a child psychiatrist because even the pediatricians can't find child psychiatrists. So the pediatrician said, "I'm not going to treat this again." Now, that pediatrician may be very good or family practitioner, but not willing to go out on a limb like that when they don't know they've got their back covered.
Right.
So this network provides a security. Now the pediatrician knows 24/7. He or she can call in and talk with a colleague and get that expert advice. So it's firming up the confidence and the competence of our primary care physicians. And that postcard that you were looking at a few minutes ago was sent out to all of the primary care physicians in Ohio with the launch of this October 7, and it's got the little magnet on it that helps the...
I already ripped it off.
That you ripped off, that helps the PCP know what number they can call. And they're working out some firewall problems right now to help that also have a website access in.
Is this something that pediatricians can feel comfortable doing with or without parental support?
I'm not sure I understand the question.
Well, in other words, is this something that they need to tell the parent? They're going to make this call. Do they need to tell the parents this first?
You know, I think that most pediatricians, I'm not sure if they mention it or not, these consults that they obtain are pretty much anonymous. This is almost sort of to be thought of as an informal sort of curbside consultation, whereas pediatrician, when they call in, they don't typically begin with a child's name or birth date or any identifying medical information, but they may say, gee, I have a 10-year-old girl who was just here in my office, and we'll have a discussion about the case as they might with a specialist that they bump into in the hall in a medical center. Does that sound correct to you,
Mary? Yeah. Dr. Sherman?
Well, that brings up another really good point, which is that this is meant to help service 100,000 children is the goal for this. And part of the success will come from the parent. So the parent or the guardian can learn about this and can be empowered and informed and go into the pediatrician or to the family practitioner and say, Dr. So-and-so, I've heard about this great program, and you know we've been struggling with such-and-such. Again, it depends on how old the child is. Here's a number you can call, and you can get backup. I think in general the families really want this support as well.
So I guess I should give this phone number out then.
Well, it's not for the families to call.
It's not for the families to call, but the family could use it to give to their physician.
You bet.
The family can let the physician know, hey, I want to speak up. I want to help take care of my child. I want my child to stay on developmental track. There's a website you can go to, doctor, and the family members can go to the website too. There are some clinical protocols on the website, the telephone number is for practitioners who have a patient in their practice to be able to better serve that patient.
We'll post the phone number for the pediatricians, and we'll also post the website for everybody on our website at wosu.org/allsides. So if you want to see that, check out the website first. You can go to our website at wosu.org. If you don't feel like doing that, it's pedpsychiatry.org, P-E-D as in dog, psychiatry.org. You want to reach 100,000 children in the first
couple of years.
Now, the administration's changing over. We only have a few more seconds, but I just wanted to ask you, is this funding for this program set for how long?
We'd love funding for this program. So maybe you can help us find funding for this program.
Okay. Well, Dr. Campo of Nationwide Children's Hospital, thank you very much.
Thank you.
And also Dr. Marian Sherman. She is Medical Director for the Ohio Department of Mental Health. Thanks for joining us today, Dr. Sherman.
My pleasure.
That is all the time we have. We're out of time. I want to thank all the folks who helped put the show together. Well, first of all, Alan DeCenzo composed our theme music, and the All-Sides staff includes producer Linda Taylor, associate producer Amy Jurovich, student production assistant Jeff Steiner, WOSU radio intern Leticia Wiggins, radio operations director Kevin Petrilla, senior broadcast technician Eric French. This is All Sides with Ann Fisher. This is listener-supported WOSU and WOSU HD 820 Columbus, and streaming on the web at WOSU.org, WOSU 820, NPR News.